We want to make quality bags. Starting this year, we work only with sustainable fabrics. Minimalistic Scandinavian design.
Strap in tight, we're unpacking the secrets of Swedish bagmaker Sandqvist's success and mulling over the importance of where and how our products are made. Today on Section D. This is Section D, Monocle 24's dedicated weekly design show, and I'm your host, Josh Fennett. Also coming up...
There's a whole history about who made it and where they made it, and I think people increasingly are engaging with objects on an emotional level because of their provenance and because of their backstories.
The thoughts there of design journalist and trade show devotee Katie Tregidden on how storytelling and the pull of provenance are changing the world of industrial design. And...
Talk of international brands... And Greece isn't likely to be the first country that'll spring to mind. Not like the cars of Italy or the aeronautical engineering of the UK.
We'll mull over the Made in Greece label with a group of makers who, despite the dour outlook, are forecasting sunny skies ahead. That's all to come on Section D on Monocle 24. Now today's episode hones in on the idea of how and where our products are made and how the stories we're told about their manufacture can buoy or destroy their credibility. Have customers changing expectations of supreme sustainability or total traceability changed the way we buy or just the amount we're willing to pay? Joining me on the line is Seer Sage design journalist and friend of the show, Katie Tregidden. Katie, as a watcher of the waves in the design industry, how important is a product's origin and is it always a factor in the customer's mind when they're picking something up to buy it?
Yes, I think it's more important than ever, actually. And I think the Rana Plaza factory disaster was a bit of a wake-up call for consumers. I think these days people want to know where things are from for several reasons. One is obviously the human rights issue. One is from an environmental standpoint. I think people want to understand how things are made and how far around the world they're being flown to get to them. And I also think there's this idea of, in an age of sort of mass production, when you can have everything... I wrote an article a little while ago about the new minimalism. So this idea that actually, what do we want in our homes? What are the things that tell stories about who we are? That when someone sort of says, oh, I like that, there's a whole history about who made it and where they made it. And I think people increasingly are engaging with objects on an emotional level because of their provenance and because of their backstories.
And provenance is a great word, and there tends to sometimes be a rather confused debate in design about what is beautiful and then how the actual industry, the cranky machinery of pushing out sofas and tables and chairs, actually reacts to what people want. Do you think this is a message that's been felt by consumers, but also throughout the industrial design industry as someone who charts and chronicles the trade fairs every year?
Yes, I do, actually. And it's really interesting to see how it's sort of filtering down from those designer makers through to the high street and products that are made on a more industrial scale. There's a real trend at trade shows for showing videos that show the making of a product. And I think that's part of this idea that actually consumers want transparency now. And I think social media has really driven that transparency because big companies have fewer places to hide. So I think there's this idea that if customers are going to see everything, then what they're seeing needs to be good and responsible and ethical.
And I've always had a rather miserly and strange sideways view of the idea of sustainability. I think if you buy something and it lasts your entire lifetime, then it is sustainable regardless of what it's made of. Perhaps other people might think that sustainability is about the carbon footprint, but if you use 10 of them, the carbon footprint will be completely different. Tell me, in your understanding, how sustainability and the notion of waste feeds into this argument about manufacturing and about the longevity of products.
I mean, I think both of those things that you've said are right. There is a move at the moment for designers to claim their products are sustainable because they last forever. And I think in principle, that's absolutely true. We should be buying things that last. The problem is that trends change. Things come in and out of fashion. People's living circumstances change. So people's houses tend to get bigger and then smaller again throughout their lifetimes. Furniture isn't handed down through families in the same way it used to be. So I think whilst we should be buying things that last, those things also need to be made in a way that's sustainable and responsible. I think waste is really interesting. A couple of years ago, when you walked around the trade shows, you were seeing lots of fascinating but slightly gimmicky products, like sofas made from salmon skin leather and sort of these things that were thought-provoking but not necessarily going to make it into the mainstream. But interestingly, at Stockholm Furniture Fair last week, Castell won an award for their harvest rug, which is entirely made from leftover spools of yarn, which otherwise would have been discarded. Now, this makes this product quite unpredictable. Even the person making it doesn't know what it's going to look like until the end. And consumers have to take a leap of faith. They have to buy one and commission one. You know, they'll have a sense of the colour scheme it's going to be in, but they won't know what it's going to look like. And it's interesting that that's working on a commercial level, that consumers are willing to take that risk in order to have a product that's ethically and sustainably made.
More from Katie a little later in the show, but first an aside. Only the foolish dare stroll the streets with their eyes fixed on a screen of a smartphone. But at Apple's new Norman Foster-designed headquarters in California, it seems the brand's commitment to transparency has come back to bump it on the head. The enormous space station-like ring is surrounded by 14-metre-high glass panels, while inside a series of workspaces are separated by glass dividers. According to news sources, however, the clarity of architectural vision has led to more than a few inadvertent and headlong collisions between distracted staff and supremely polished walls. Our metaphorical mailbag is always open to queries and suggestions. Do get in touch by emailing our researcher, Daphne Karnesis. She's at dk@monocle.com. This is Section D. Do stay tuned. Swedish accessories brand Sandqvist was born in 2004 after Anton Sandqvist's fruitless search for a smart laptop bag that didn't cost the earth. It drove him to create his own. He then formed a company with his younger brother Daniel and pal Sebastian. The Sandqvist brand offers a strapping range of bags and boasts 6 shops from Gothenburg to London and Paris with a new space in Mitte. Monocle contributor Susan Stone sat down with co-founders Daniel Sandqvist and Sebastian Westin at their recently opened Berlin Bolt Hole to talk sustainability and whether or not their success is defying what's known as the law of Janta, a socially informed set of tenets that keeps Scandinavian designers and entrepreneurs humble.
I'm Daniel Sandqvist, one of the founders of the company. I've been doing basically everything since the start, selling, designing, even some production and stuff like that. But now I'm focusing on the brand as a brand manager.
And I am Sebastian Westin, also one of the founders. I kind of have done the same thing as Daniel, everything, but a lot of marketing. But now I'm also working as a brand manager, making sure the Sandqvist brand looks good everywhere.
Everywhere includes Berlin, where we're sitting right now, and this is, I believe, your second store outside of Sweden.
Yes, we actually have a shop in Paris as well, but it's the second flagship store that we have outside of Sweden. The first one was opened a year ago in London.
For someone who hasn't seen the bags and the brand, how do you explain the Sandqvist aesthetic?
Very Scandinavian simplicity over the design, and also a certain functionality, and also the durable and good fabrics that we use stand out.
I agree. A bag is functional in itself because you use it to carry stuff. So the easier it is to use it, the more functional it is. We want to make quality bags, bags that last long. We want to use good fabrics. Starting this year, we work only with sustainable fabrics. Minimalistic Scandinavian design.
Are the bags 100% sustainable now?
No, it's not 100%. But from this fall, we are changing all the cotton canvas, which is kind of a big part of the fabrics that we use, to organic cotton, which is a super big step. And all the polyester is recycled polyester. We have said that in 2020 we're going to be 80% sustainable, but I think we already are, more or less.
So it's also changing the lining and I mean, it's more than the outer material as well. So we have to consider...
Even the labels are now made in sustainable material.
The problem for us, worth to mention, is the leather that we work with, which is hard to make sustainable because it is what it is. But our plan moving forward is to work with gold-rated tanneries so you can actually track where the hides are from and stuff like that. So we want to be as sustainable as possible everywhere. But the goal is probably already reached. 80%.
Yeah, 80%, but now the goal is 100%.
Is this something that is more important for your team or also for your customers?
It's important for us.
Yeah, it's important for us. Yeah, definitely. But I think also every brand possible should try to be as sustainable as possible because we have one place to live on. So we need to take care of it. And I think the demand will be bigger and bigger. If we can be as close to 100% as possible, it kind of give us a head start of a lot of other brands in our niche.
But for us, it's always been about making long-lasting product using a good fabric from the start that will last longer. And that itself is part of our sustainability work.
I understand you also have a repair shop. You have a bag tailor, which I think is such a great name.
Yeah, we have a bag tailor based in Stockholm. So he have all the repair parts. And if your bag breaks or if you just want to, you know, pimp it in a way, you can leave it with him. And in a couple of days, he has probably fixed it to the better. It's better to repair than throw and buy a new one. And we want to do that in Berlin as well.
And does this reuse also include selling secondhand bags?
Right now we sell in Stockholm, we call it the Recollection, where we sell bags that he has repaired, taking parts from one or two or three bags, making it like a completely unique bag, one of a kind, really cool.
Now you have picked out a bag for us to talk about here.
It's a backpack. This is a really good backpack that kind of become kind of a iconic backpack for us. It's been alive for, I don't know, 2 years or so, called Hege. This particular one is in black cotton canvas, organic cotton, with black leather. Why I chose it was because it kind of embraced the whole Scandinavian design vibe of it.
Black leather on the black canvas and with the silver
trims
gives it sort of a sophisticated look. But still very traditional. It's very simple in its design.
It's kind of a backpack that you can see on both people wearing suits as well as like the hipster, you know, outside of this shop. It works on all people that wants to look good.
And also it's a unisex style, unisex design.
And in terms of the branding, if we turn it around and look at the front, the logo is quite subtle and it's this like sort of nice, almost matte silver embossed as well.
Mm. Swedish people, I don't know, if we're going to, you know, simplify things. We're not about showing off, we're not bragging. We have a thing called Jante, the Jante Lord. It means don't brag, basically. Don't say you're better than anyone. In Sweden, it's kind of a saying, don't be such a Jante. And that means that you are shy and don't make too much noise of yourself. And this bag kind of says... It's a really nice looking bag, but it doesn't scream, look at me. But if you look at it, it looks really beautiful.
So no show-offs then?
No show-offs. Just if you can be yourself and still look good, that's better than, you know, scream to people, hey, look at me, I'm looking good. We were talking to some people about the sustainability work that we have done for a long time, but it's first now that we are able to talk about it. We don't want to be the brand that just like say, hey, we do sustainability work and then we just like do 1% of the production. When we start talking about it, we want it to be like at least 60, 70, 80% of the collection. And I think that's something that we are quite proud of to do.
And not being a Jante.
Exactly. We are not Jante. Or we are Jante.
Yeah, I think we are. But, you know, it's all about being true.
Yeah.
To Daniel Sandqvist and Sebastian Vestin there in conversation with Susan Stone. Still with me is design journalist Katie Tregidden. Katie, when it comes to the minimalist style, Sandqvist and its ilk have the market cornered with a kind of beautiful Scandinavian minimalism. But there are bigger Scandinavian firms, I'm thinking of course of Hay and IKEA, that do things on a larger scale, mass produced, but with this kind of plainer style. How do you reconcile this with the fact that people want to buy one-off items that are special and individual?
They're not necessarily mutually exclusive. Something that's handmade and bespoke doesn't necessarily need to be sort of overly decorative. And I think there is a move towards this sort of very Scandinavian, understated style of design. I've been thinking about this quite a lot because obviously Scandinavian influence is huge at the moment. And I think it's perhaps got something to do with the fact that in Britain we industrialized very quickly and very brutally. And I think we lost our connection to where our food comes from and to nature and to where products come from. We sort of lost that connection. The Scandinavian countries industrialized much more slowly. And I think culturally those nations have a much closer connection to nature and to the environment. And so I think naturally people working in that culture make in a quieter, more responsible way. So I think that's perhaps something that, certainly as we undergo this digital revolution that's happening now, I think British people are looking to Scandinavian countries to sort of reconnect with nature and reconnect with that sense of responsibility in the way we use resources.
And I think that made-in phenomenon is a very interesting thing. I suppose over the past 20 or 30 years, some companies that mass-produce some products, to be diplomatic, have been lured away to places that can make them cheaper without the same sense of quality control. But we're having a curious moment, which I think you'll have also identified, where people begin reshoring their production, and it becomes important to the brand's story, but also to the quality and to being able to kind of look over the process by which things are made to maybe bring them back to the country of origin. My question for you is this happening a little bit late? If I want to set up a company, say, in the UK that makes furniture or that manufactures clothes, do we still have people around that can actually make them and it won't cost the earth?
There are still a huge amount of manufacturing skills in Britain and in other industrialised countries. Mark Product, for example, manufacturing Cornwall, Castell are still manufacturing in Sweden, Carl Hansen and Son are still manufacturing in Denmark. The issue of cost is there, though. If you're going to pay people a living wage and you're going to pay people for the craft skills that they've got, then there's a cost implication. And I think a lot of this stuff, we're in danger of being in a little bit of a middle-class bubble with some of this stuff. And that's why much maligned IKEA, they do actually make furniture which is affordable for people who have to buy their own furniture, in inverted commas. Not everybody gets antiques handed down from their grandparents. And I think it's really important that some of this stuff filters down to the high street and to brands that are accessible to normal people. And it's as important, if not more important, that those bigger brands are taking their sustainability seriously, which I think is something that IKEA are really starting to look at in depth.
So you've mentioned IKEA and you've mentioned Castell. Are the Scandinavian nations the only people in the world that are mastering this balance of making things within the country and telling good stories? Or are there other markets that you're excited about as well, say the made in Italy or the increasingly important made in kind of Portugal market, particularly in fashion?
Interestingly, there's a huge amount of production in Portugal and in Poland. And historically, the design and the manufacturing have been slightly separated. And so you've had a lot of production and a lot of design, but never the twain shall meet. And there are big moves now happening to connect those things back up. So you have beautifully designed contemporary products that are made with the manufacturing skills that are still in those countries. So I think there are some really exciting things happening in countries outside of Scandinavia, which is, if you look at Instagram, sometimes hard to believe. But yeah, I guess Scandinavia are leading the charge at the moment, and it's up to other countries to sort of follow their lead.
Katie Tregidden there, spilling a few wise words on brand provenance and how the stories we're told about a product can affect the price we're willing to pay for it. Last up, we head to a nation where economic uncertainty is at risk of upsetting the olive cart when it comes to making products at home. I'm talking, of course, about Greece and the financial crisis that has made the words design, innovation and industry rarer than they might have been. With a manufacturing sector dating back millennia, Greece has survived more than a few bankruptcies, wars and upsets. In fact, the sectors that have flourished over the past few centuries, because rather than in spite of economic shifts, may well surprise you. Our Athens correspondent Natalie Savarakis has this report.
Talk of international brands, and Greece isn't likely to be the first country that'll spring to mind. Not like the cars of Italy, the household appliances of Germany, or the aeronautical engineering of the UK. But once upon a time, the crisis-battered country was doing surprisingly well. An exhibition titled 160 Years Made in Greece hopes to showcase the nation's industrial diversity and dynamism by chronicling the main innovations.
Greece is now on the threshold of a new golden age. But this time, instead of erecting temples to ancient gods, the Greeks are building modern factories and plants.
The idea of the exhibition came mainly from a need to show to the Greek public and the visitors of the exhibition that this country was productive in multiple sectors, and of course that its industry was not a sub-industry in the periphery of Europe, but it had its own share in terms of innovation and pioneering production.
The exhibition's historian, Yannis Stoyanidis, offers a quick glimpse into the innovative sectors of Greece's industry and design.
When does the golden age of the Greek industry take place, and why does it come to an end?
What we call a golden age starts after World War II. With Marshall Plan, the Greek industries managed to repair the damages, some of them, and some others to renew their equipment, which helps them to stand equally in the international competitive market. At that time, we have some new sectors in Greek industry, like pharmaceutics. Well, it's the kickoff of the Greek pharmaceutics. And at the same time, we have also oil refineries.
Are there any interesting profiles that have emerged during that golden era when it comes to Greek design?
Well, there is a certain sector that has, we could call it an evolution at that time. It's definitely the furniture industry, which is quite traditional till that time. I mean, till the post-war era, that time they realized that they have to change their design, their patterns. So the first interesting story comes from Eleftherios Saridi. He's a furniture maker. Saridi produces chairs and beds mainly by copying the designs of ancient Greeks that were depicted on the vases of the classical period. His expensive furniture becomes really popular till 1990s when international celebrities buy his furniture and they hire him for the interior design of their houses.
So can you talk us through who are the main personalities who have contributed to innovation?
I think I will refer to some special cases, like, for example, the case of Viohalco. It's a metalworks industry. It was established in the interwar period. Later on, it was grown significantly. Today, it holds different industrial units in various European countries, like Greece, Bulgaria, and Albania and Serbia. It is an industry that produces various metallic products which are being exported in other countries in Europe and other places. I would like to mention the case of Petzetakis industry. This is an innovative idea. Petzetakis produces for the first time flexible PVC plastic pipelines, which are an international patent produced in Greece. He establishes his factories in 1970s. He is what we call a sui generis inventor. He has a very large exporting activity, but due to the late economic crisis, his industry shut down in 2015. Innovation is also connected or related to Greek pharmaceutics. Pharmaceutics industry produce various drugs either for the Greek market or for the international market. All of them invest on the education and improvement of their scientific personnel. That's why they also create their own research centers where they study ways of improving their drugs in collaboration with Greek universities.
So why don't you think Greece didn't manage to maintain the momentum in its industrial development like its neighboring countries? What held it back?
I think it's a threefold answer. Labor unions and the ecological movements. The idea in the labor unions is that workers should claim and manage themselves the factories without any businessmen. large strikes against the industrial development. At the same time, the Greek society wants to get rid of the industrial culture, which is related in their minds with pollution. Secondly, the lack of political backing to the idea of industry. There are not a lot of examples of politicians who supported the Greek industry. Last but not least, I should mention the problem of the Greek industry in 1970s and 1980s is not, we could say, ready to face international competition.
Despite these setbacks, though, the industry is picking up again. Factory activity is rising at its fastest pace in 10 years. A plethora of small businesses are operating in the food sector. The 100-year-old Nomikos tomato processing business stands as one of the biggest in Europe, Heinz and Marks and Spencer among its many clients. Other sectors are making headway too, like pharmaceutical Elpen, which exports to 4 continents and nearly 40 countries. But the resilience of the Greek industry isn't enough. Political encouragement is imperative. Favorable taxation, harnessing the nation's overqualified skilled labor, and the never-ending bureaucracy are just a few issues that need reforming. And lastly, smart branding, so the world at large can finally recognize products which are made in Greece. For Monocle, this is Natalie Savarikas.
Next week.
So happen very often that people just stay for a tour, for drink a coffee or drink a Prosecco that you can buy or not is not very important for us.
We speak to the CEO of Venetian brand Slowware about creating welcoming shop spaces and the future of Italian tailoring. Section D was produced by Ben Ryland, researched by Daphne Karnesis, and edited by Christy Evans. Don't forget, if you can't wait, there are always more design delights to uncover in the pages of Monocle magazine. But for now, I'm Josh Fennett. Thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.